Frank, in this section of our discussion is give you an idea of the ways in which the Anishinaabe regarded Musquito, the fly agaric, the ways in which it was used. Gordon alluded earlier to the rather ambivalent attitude amongst various groups, and I think that was also brought out in the story of the scroll. Then what we're going to do is open up the session for questions. And we'll be here as long as we can talk, I guess. As you remember, as a young girl, Kiwaden Okwe was apprenticed in the traditional manner to an Ojibwe Mashkiki Kwe, an herbalist named Ojima Kwe. This apprenticeship was to last approximately six years until about 1930. It was during this time that Ki first learned about the fly agaric.
Awful name to give it.
Fly agaric, yes, we all agree that. Before that time, you were just given sort of general admonishments by the adults to avoid
it. Any of the poisonous mushrooms.
They considered it poisonous.
No. Any of the mushrooms that had this bulb at the bottom of it, they would show them to us. They'd take a fork, stick, and pull it apart so we could see it. And there was always a few leaves and dirt, you know, clinging to the bulb at the base. And they'd pull it back and they'd say, that's a skull and crossbones. And if you have anything to do with that, that's what will happen to you. And of course, we left them alone.
But your teacher, your mentor, Nojima Kwe, did more than just tell you to stay away from him, didn't she?
Yes, she was, as Watanabe said, she was fanatic about the Musquito, and I knew that, but I didn't know why. I sensed that there was an emotional element, and I had often said to my mother, did Nojima Kwe ever have any children? And my mother would always turn me off, because my mother was a very proper sort of a person, and she felt one shouldn't interfere with the intimate lives of others. And one day, I just came right out and I asked Nojima Kwe why she hated the Musquito so, because when we go out in the woods, she had a special container that she would collect them in, and she even had a special kind of wooden tongs, like gigantic chopsticks that she'd collect them with. And then when we go back to the Meshkiki Kwe, the little herbal house, she had a stone oven where she was under the impression. See, now I've studied mycology, I know better, but she was under the impression that if she burned them in this, that she was also burning the spores and that they would, there'd never be any more of them. And she just pounced on them, she hated them. And I kept saying, why do you hate them so? And because there were other things that were poisonous, like poison ivy, and she didn't feel that way about it. And she'd just say, well, someday I'll tell you. And then one day she did tell me, and I almost wish she hadn't. It was so sad. But she had one daughter, whose name was Daisy. And Daisy came under the influence of a Jasakeed who was not a good Jasakeed, who was, in fact, evil. And he used the inebriating power of the Musquito to keep his women. He kept them seeing visions most of the time. So he did. And he lived in our area for a long time, I understand, and when he left, he took seven with him, and he left as many dead in the graveyard, and among them was the young daughter of Nojima Kwe. And that's why she hated it so.
You then found later, though, that there were...
Well, I just took what she said, and that coupled with what they had said to me when I was younger about leaving it alone, I just left it alone. I always kind of wondered why it was, I found out from Grandmother Norton, who was my immediate predecessor.
As a Mashkikikwe?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And what did you find out from her?
Well, I didn't really find out from her directly. I saw something happen that stirred me greatly. And I almost hesitate to tell it. Maybe everybody will discredit everything else I have to say. It's so fantastic. Well, but it's the truth. I was about, I don't know, maybe 11, something like that. And our people used to work a great deal on the car ferries in the Great Lakes. And very often the cars would get loose down in the holds of the ship, especially when there were bad storms. And this one occasion, a man had been pinned down underneath these cars, and they got loose and came together and just smashed them, you know. The whole side was smashed. And they had wired ahead when they were taking him into port and sent for a priest, and the doctor said it was nothing we can do at all, you know, just smashed this whole thing. Particularly his side, his right arm. And his friends, he had some friends who were from the Fisher families in the islands, and they put him in one of their boats and they brought him up to Grandmother Norton. And when I saw this man, I was there for another ceremony, and my family was, and they brought this man off the boat, and I remember vividly this arm. There was just nothing left of it. It was just like shreds of tendons and sinew, and you couldn't even recognize it was an arm. And then the people in the village kind of clustered around and looked, you know, and what I said, and the man kind of fainted away. And then I heard everybody saying, "Well, he'll die. We'll just go dig a grave." And then Grandmother Norton said, "No." And they said, "You're not going to do it, are you?" And she said, "Yes, I am." And I didn't know what they were talking about. So I was a snippy little kid, and stand there and find out what it was they were going to do. Well, there were three men and Grandmother Norton, and they built, and it's so long ago that I couldn't honestly say that. They were a ceramic company. Yeah. And it was a big one. And they were suspended. It was a homemade seat. And because the man couldn't stand. And then one of these men played a drum as long as he could. So it became so meager, he couldn't play anymore. And Grandmother Norton and these three men and the man who was in the tripod and kind of came back to the consciousness drank some stuff out of a birch bark container. And they stood there, the three men, and around the tripod, and the man sitting there at the time. 9 o'clock in the morning, so sunset at night. Immobile. And they disappeared once in a while like this with a big fat container. And I didn't have any idea what was going on then, but I noticed that when they came back from this, that they took this container over and they would give it to the man to drink, or they would give it to each other to drink. And I didn't know what was happening, but I didn't realize the message place and what was happening then. But what I did see, and I am telling you the truth, those two people stood there, and that man sat there, and the flies buzzed around and it was terrible. And he never moved, and they didn't move, and the people of the village went around and hushed home. And slowly but surely, the muscles and the tendons and the skin and the bones in that man's arms went back into place. And by sunset, there was, where there had been just shreds, something which did resemble an arm and a hand. And I saw him afterwards because I was tremendously curious. And saw him a number of years afterwards, too. And although it didn't ever look like somebody had done plastic surgery on it, and it looked as like it had been wounded, it was healed up, and he was able to flex the muscles, and he was able to hold things with his fingers.
And then you asked Grandmother Norton what...
And then I had to know, of course, what they had done. And that's how I found out about the Mosquito.
And after she told you about it, did you experiment with it?
No, I was absolutely horrified. It took me a couple of years before I could bring myself to inquire any further.
I remember something about a cat.
Oh, that's why. That wasn't the Mosquito I used in the cat. That was the puffball.
Oh.
I got cleansed for that. I was using it for trying out to see if puffballs were anesthetic to get to that little girl.
Yeah.
That wasn't the Mosquito.
But what happened to the cat? Just, I'm sure they're curious now.
Oh, the cat went to sleep, and my dad had a mop. The cat didn't get up and go away, of course, and my dad ran over it. Every time I see a black and white cat, I feel guilty. Because it was my fault, I killed Sweetie.
That's sort of like animal experimentation in modern pharmacology, though, isn't it?
Yes, but you see, we look at it differently.
I understand.
I have to be nice to all black and white cats to make up for it.
There were other than serious purposes connected with the use of the Mosquito, weren't there? People used it for frivolous purposes.
Well, yes, I don't like to say that, and I am sort of guilty of omitting telling our young people about that. I don't mention it can be used that way, but it's true it was. Was, is, we aren't past tense.
There was a woman who didn't take it, who wished.
Yes, there are admonitory tales, and somebody in the group that was up here asking about that. There are folk-like tales among our people warning against using the Mosquito frivolously, lightly, for unworthy purpose, and so forth. And the one that you're talking about is a young woman. I feel kind of sorry about this, but anyway, this is the way the tale goes. This young woman had married very early, and she never really had anything nice of her own. But she had one great talent. She was a very fine dancer. And she always felt that if she had the proper sort of a dancing costume and could afford to pay, that is, give offerings to a real good drummer, that she probably could take a lot of dancing prizes and, you know, sort of make herself a place in the family. And so she took the Mosquito, and she her petition in doing so was she would like to have, please, a very beautiful dancing costume, one that would just startle everybody and make everybody look when she walked out. But if that was too much to ask for, then she asked for a vision of a pattern that would be unusual and different from anybody else's, because dancing costumes were kept and handed down, and everybody knew the detail of the pattern of everybody else's, and she wanted one that was really different. So this is what she did. And it was known, you know, that people saw patterns and colors and that sort of thing, so that's what she was asking for. And she did, she received her petition, the answer to her petition, all right, but when she woke, when she came out of the, what you call the euphoric state, her right leg was twisted and she could never dance again. Now that is, I mean, there's no point in going on with the stories like that. There are numbers of them that I have heard that I've heard people tell, you know, the kind of stories they tell when they sit around the table and drink tea, you know, and then there was old Andy so-and-so who did this and that, and, you know, that kind of thing.
What you're saying is you don't want to talk about the other two?
No, I'm saying that coming out of a twisted limbs or a twisted mouth or something twisted is a very common effect and was considered by our people to be a sign that they had used the Mosquito unworthily.
There was a time where you thought when you thought that it you might be using it for an unworthy purpose, but it turned out in the final analysis that it was not.
Well, I was really scared about that one. I think what I learned out of that one was that, you know, that I shouldn't always be an elder brother and worry that I don't understand. That when it happened, I taught country school. And if you don't know, you can guess what it's like in a small country community where everybody knows all your business and everything. And I had to be more careful than many of the teachers because being an Indian in a community where there was still prejudice, and where there still is prejudice, by the way, they noticed things and they gossiped about them, and they would actually use it against you. I mean, I could lose my position if something looked, you know, moral or something like that. All right. There was in our county this woman that we Indians had always suspected of being Indian because she understood our language, but you couldn't tell by her look. She dyed her hair bright red, and but her husband was extremely well-to-do, that is, from an Indian's angle. They had a little private airport and several planes and a nice big boat and a small cauliflower factory, etc. And she lost a diamond ring that he gave her on an anniversary, a great big whopper that she used to go around startling everybody with. And she came to me and she said, "I want you to use the mushroom," and this is the word she used, the mushroom, "to find the ring." And because she did it properly and she brought me a gift of sacred tobacco, I couldn't refuse it. And so I said I would, but it's a little difficult thing to do. I mean, you know, in an intimate community like that, you know, you can't go around intoxicated, and I certainly would have lost my job. And so I kind of put it off. I was told there was a time and a place where I could do it. But she misunderstood my putting it off, and she thought that I had, or she had a real faith in the Mosquito, and that I would be able to find it for her. And she thought that I had actually found it, and that I had kept the ring. And so she went to the local police and told them that I had found her ring and that I was keeping it. And then she came to me and she said, "If you don't give me the ring, then I will tell everybody in the school board, you know, that you have illegal inebriating mushrooms and you lose your job." And I had young children at home and I was alone and supporting them, and I was really in a snit over that one. So I finally decided that the best thing to do was to find the ring for it. So I went out into one of the old Indian cemeteries where it's kind of quiet because nobody goes there anymore. And I took it, and my daughter went with me to kind of look after me. And I got the fastest answer I ever had to a petition right away. I could see it. There it was in a pile of dust and dirt under something big and white and metallic, and it was vibrating and an engine in it. So I went to her house and I said, "It's in your own house and it's under some sort of an appliance, a washer, a dryer, a refrigerator, something like that." And she said, "Oh no, for one thing, I always clean very carefully under all of my appliances." And her husband said, "Well, you know, honey, it won't hurt to look. Well, if he says it's there, you know, take a look." So we looked under the washer and it wasn't there. And we looked under the dryer and there it was. And so she had a ring, and she didn't even say thanks. I was hoping that if she didn't really want to declare herself as one of us, that she probably, in thanks, would maybe give the Native American Association a nice little donation or something like that, you know. But she didn't. She didn't even call the police. They kept heckling me. Finally, I went down and saw Gus myself, and I said, "Look, Gus is the police." And I said, "You know, she's got a ring." And he says, "Oh, good." But it was very near a catastrophe for our small family. It could have been very bad.
So in that case, it wasn't frivolous, although for her it was.
You know, and you see, I had been thinking of it that way, as regaining a material possession. But then I afterwards realized that it really was the help that came for my family, for me, not for her to get a ring. Because they do have a lot of influence there.
You got guidance from the Mosquito then. There was another...
Yeah, that was very... It was a very clear picture.
There was another incident in which the Mosquito was used for for guidance, for renaming.
Oh, well, that's really to change it. A spirit.
Well, why don't you
tell
everybody?
Well, one of the Fisher families, this is, I was only involved in this because I knew the people very well. One of the Fisher families up home, and Watanabe met them, they had a young son that he just pined away, you know, they just, it was obvious that the little boy was dying. They had him to the clinic on the mainland, and they had him to the local hospital, and they paid for masses to be said, and lit candles, and said litanies, and I don't know what all, and he'd swallowed so much medicine that he got nauseated, and nothing did any good. And John just got smaller and smaller, and his knobs of his bones stood out, and you could see that the Pavlikisa, when his hand of death was on him. And so finally his parents went to Grandmother Norton and said, would you try the old Indian way and see if renaming him, like they used to do, would help his health? And she said she would. But at that time, Grandmother Norton was very much needed by our people. She was the only doctor for Indians and whites on all the islands. And also, she hadn't trained an apprentice to take her place yet. And part of the deal is that when it's something like a whole life that's at stake, the person who offers themselves to the Nisqually must be willing, if it is required of them, to give their life for the new life, because they were asking a new life for this child, because obviously he was already marked for death. Everybody could see it. So rather than do it herself, she went to a very ancient man who lived on the west side of Beaver Island at that time by the name of Bejigwewere, and he followed the old traditional ways, and she asked him if he would be willing to give his life for little John. And he said that he would. So he took the mushroom and asked for a vision, what should be done, and if the child should be named, if so, what. In the meantime, Shawanakwe, that's his mother, we've met Shawanakwe, started getting ready for a big feast, because that's the way that it's done. And they invited all the friends. And then Grandmother Norton, and a couple of her helpers went to the little hut where Bejigwewere was, and they brought him out, and he stood up and he told what had happened. And he said that it was true that the child's spirit was marked for death, but that the parents had been virtuous people, good members of the community, had always done things the way they should. And one thing that they'd overlooked was that they hadn't given that child an Indian name, and his spirit never had an identity. And so that it was going back to the pool of all spirits. And then the parents began to cry because they thought that meant he was going to die. And he said, and the spirit that is within him, behold, it is already going, but he will have a new one. And he was to be named Nagusa, which means I have a new spirit. When you came out to visit me, Nagusa was the young man that operated the boat for his father. And I'm glad to say that he's always been mindful of the fact that he had a new life. And he's the kind of fisherman that doesn't take too many fish and doesn't take the wrong kind. And he's one of the ones that's going to lose his boat because the state of Michigan has decided that Indians shouldn't be able to fish anymore because it takes the fish away from the sport. But anyway, he lives, and he has three handsome sons. Yes, he did. No. So no one knows whether it was because of that or not. You know, I mean, who knows? Because he was very old anyway. He was, well, you know, he didn't know really for sure, but he always said he was over 100. He looked it. And he was a good man. It was a way of honor for him to go, if that was it. Of course, we're not to say.